thank you very much, and it's very good to be here to talk about the National Flood Resilience Review and what I think is going to follow on from that. We can see here four pictures. At the very top over there is that very well-known picture of Tewkesbury Abbey, 2007, which led to the Pitt Review, from which came the Flood Forecasting Centre, which is jointly operated by the Environment Agency and the Met Office. And since then, I think it's fair to say that the forecasting of floods and the nature of the warnings that we're able to give have made a huge difference to this country's resilience. But nevertheless, since 2007, we've had the Cockermouth floods in 2009, the Somerset levels there in the winter of 2013-14, and now, of course, Carlisle as an example of what happened to us this past winter in 2015-16. So this is more about, do we really understand our exposure to flooding? We're getting quite good at flood forecasting, but do we really understand the risks that we as a nation face from flooding across the piece, across the whole country? And what can we do to make ourselves more resilient, better prepared for these sorts of events? So here we are again. This last winter, I put surprised again, because the amount of rainfall that we experienced in Storm Desmond in early December was quite extraordinary. Doug Wilson will cover a bit more of this when he speaks. But there's no doubt that we were surprised again at the amount of rainfall and the severity of the flooding that occurred in northwest England. And of course, the first question that people sort of say is, well, is this climate change? Well, of course, actually, when you really look at the records, it's hard to say that it is climate change. This is one thing we do have to be very clear about. There's no doubt, and I've written extensively on this over the last few years, that climate change may play a role, but actually when you look at the records, it's hard to say, give a definitive answer at this time. The top figure is the winter rainfall for England and Wales, for what we call the hydrological winter, October to March. And what we can see there, actually, when we look over 100 years, is in fact that we've been through some rain-rich and rain-poor periods, and that actually our rainfall in the last decade or so, when we've had these increasing incidents of flooding, is not that different from what the rainfall was at the beginning of the 20th century. It's very hard to find a signal of climate change in that 100-year record when we look at long seasonal averages and over large areas. Of course, actually, when we drill down and we start looking at daily and sub-daily data, there is an emerging signal of more intense rainfall in short bursts. And we would expect to see that just from simple moist thermodynamics, from simple physics. And we're beginning to detect that. But when we look at these longer term monthly averages or seasonal averages, what jumps out actually is this huge volatility of the record. The natural variability in UK rainfall is huge. And it dominates everything. The lower figure is actually the seven at Bewdley. And again, when you look at these long records of river flows, again, hard to see a climate change signal. There are again periods of flood-rich and flood-poor periods that coincide pretty much with the rain-rich and rain-poor periods. One of our problems in assessing flood risk and talking about climate change is that a lot of our records actually only cover the last 30 or 40 years. And if I hadn't shown you the first part of this record, and the same with river flows, you would have said, oh, yes, looking at those recent decades, there's a signal of increasing rainfall and a signal of increasing river flows. One of our great problems in this country is that we only have really 100 years of data and yet we have this remarkable, huge natural variability. And so what one sort of has to look at now when we think about our landscape of risk from natural hazards, particularly hydrometeorological hazards, is that natural variability is going to really be a dominant factor, at least for the next two or three decades. And I don't think we've really fully grasped that, that this is really what we're talking about, is the natural variability. We go back in history and find documentation of extreme floods, of extreme rainfall, of other extreme meteorological events. So it's hard to disentangle climate change from all of this. So we were asked by Oliver Letwin at that time, what's a plausible worst case? In fact, he asked the Met Office, what's a plausible worst case for rainfall? Well, that's an incredibly difficult question. It was the first time that actually rainfall had been questioned in relation to flood risk. That all the work that had been done prior to that, flood risk had started with river flow data, with flooding data. But of course, we all know that if you want to look at a plausible worst case for UK flooding, it actually doesn't start with rainfall, it starts with the weather. It starts with the sort of patterns of weather that set themselves up and bring copious amounts of rainfall to this country. In the winter of 2013-14, we had an incredibly strong jet stream and a continuous run of very, very deep depressions. In fact, the lowest pressures we've pretty well observed running to the north of the country. And of course, we remember that alongside the very severe flooding that occurred, particularly down the Thames, we also had the breaching of a lot of our coastal defences. It was a very strong westerly winter, and we understood with the origins of that. It had come out of a very disturbed jet stream that reached right back into the tropical West Pacific, associated with La Nina conditions. This winter, here's Storm Desmond, then the weather map that was iconic, really, for Storm Desmond is this huge southwesterly flow. This is what we call an atmospheric river. It was like a hose pipe pointing at Cumbria for hours and hours and hours, and just absolutely dumping vast amounts of water onto the Cumbrian fells. And in this southwesterly flow, we can see these little waves along these fronts, these little low-pressure systems that tracked along this southwesterly flow. This is perfectly plausible meteorologically. There's nothing sort of unusual about this in the sense that we know atmospheric rivers often lead to flooding, particularly in winter. This was unusual because it was aimed right at Cumbria, and the hills of Cumbria just released all this water that was coming up in this hose pipe, basically. So what I'm saying is that when we need to look at flood risk, we need to actually look at what the weather is up to. And one of the things of the reasons why our weather is so variable in winter is because there are many multiple drivers of our weather. We sit at the edge of the North Atlantic. We receive all the weather that comes across the North Atlantic. And we have this thing called the North Atlantic Oscillation, which essentially characterises our winter weather with low pressure to the north near Iceland, and high pressure down here to the south in the Azores. And when that pressure gradient is strengthened, we get these very mild wet winters, what we call the positive phase of the North Atlantic Oscillation. And over the last few years, we've done a lot of research, both in the Met Office and in the academic sector, trying to understand what predisposes our winter weather to be in these sorts of conditions, mild and wet, very much what we saw this last winter. And there are a whole range of drivers, from the 11-year solar cycle, potentially the changing Arctic volcanoes, stratospheric winds, El Nino, and we know that that played a role in the early winter prevalence of this mild wet weather that we had last winter, a tropical weather pattern, and also the sea surface temperatures over the North Atlantic. We've learnt how many of these drivers affect our weather, to the degree that actually the seasonal forecast that we published in October and November last year already noted the risks of spells of windy or even stormy weather is expected to be greater than usual for the time of year. So there's a lot we now understand about what drives the natural variability of our climate, our winter climate, and we can use that knowledge to understand, therefore, our exposure to flood risk arising from natural variability in our weather patterns. Slight sideways step now to Ed Lorentz and the Essence of Chaos. Because one of the things that he said was that one flap of a seagull's wings may forever change the course of the weather. And we use this concept widely now in forecasting. We never make a single forecast now. We make a whole ensemble of forecasts, and we talk about probabilities. Because what Ed Lorentz said was very tiny perturbations can radically alter the future course of the weather. And what that means, of course, is that you can regard, of course, that the observations that we have, the 100 years of observations we have, are, of course, only one possible path that the world's weather could have taken in the last 100 years. All sorts of things, a flap of a seagull's wings, could have changed the course of that weather. In other words, observations are just one plausible realization of what the world's weather could be like, and that it could have gone in many other ways, all with the same external forcing agents. And so when we were asked this question, well, what's a plausible worst case for rainfall? You sort of said, well, can I actually go and think about this beyond the 100 years of data that I've got, which I know barely samples the myriad of ways in which the weather can set itself up over the UK? Can I use climate model simulations to find plausible alternatives that are meteorologically and physically plausible, with even more extreme rainfall than anything we've observed in the last 100 years? And that was the basis on which we went at this problem. So it's a different approach. And basically what we're looking for are black swans, known unknowns, whatever you want to look at, things that we know could be out there just from natural variability, but which we haven't yet observed because we've only sampled one possible pathway of the world's weather, and there are a myriad of other pathways that it could have taken. And so weather and climate simulation essentially provides many, many synthetic realisation of the UK's weather, provided that, first of all, the climate model produces a plausible simulation of synoptic weather, like those weather maps I showed earlier on, and rain and UK rainfall. That's a big ask. And actually, I think it's only now that we're at the cusp of having models that can do that. If you'd asked me 5-10 years ago, I would have said they're not good enough. But with the improvements in resolution, improvements in the physics of the models, we now have climate models that can do that, at least for synoptic weather. You then actually also have to have a set of simulations that, of course, sample the same forcings as the real world, such as greenhouse gas forcings, but still have sufficient freedom to evolve to different regional climate and weather regimes. So they can't be too constrained to replicate the observed record, because that's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to find plausible pathways of the world's weather that would be perfectly possible within the greenhouse gas forcings or the low frequency variability of the Atlantic Ocean, say, that the real world has experienced in the last few decades. And so what we did was to actually, we had 6 weeks to do this work, so we had to go with what we got, and we had actually 1,400 years of simulation for the last 35 years, which we've used within our operational decadal prediction system, which is now using our latest high-resolution coupled ocean-atmosphere climate model. So we had 1,400 years that are representative of what we are currently in this rain-rich period with recent greenhouse gases. So in other words, climate change that has already happened is factored into those simulations. And when you do that, what you find is that you can you essentially define more exactly the distribution of rainfall over large regions of the country. This is, we've just talked you through this, what this shows. So this is looking across the winter months, and in the black, we've got for each of the 35 years, from 1980 to 2015, the rainfall, in this case, over southeast England. So we could only do it in sort of reasonably large areas of England because the model resolution is still not that great. We've more ways and more to go here. That's the observational distribution in black. There's actually the January from 2014, which is the Thames flooding, so it was a real outlier, we can see that. And then in pink and red are the distributions of the rainfall for southeast England from the model. And what we've coloured in red here, it's a very broad distribution. There are many, many samples. We've coloured the members, the number of times the simulations say actually it's quite possible to have more extreme rainfall than we've observed in the last 35 years. And so we've got here, this is the issue, 35 observed winters in the recent past with the latest greenhouse gas forcings versus 1,400 simulations. We've got 40 times more data to play with to fill out the tail of the extremes of the distribution. Here we're looking at the very wet extremes, but of course down here we can see that you could fill out also the very dry winters. So this applies to many, many of the risks we face from the environment. So there we are. We've been able to show, actually, there are quite a large number of occasions where the meteorology sets itself up to give us much more rainfall than we've observed in the recent past, but all meteorologically plausible. And I stuck these weather maps from one of these in front of our chief meteorologist and said, would you recognise this as a severe weather situation? He said, yes, I fully understand that. That looks just exactly like the sort of weather we observe. That's a really important test. But of course, the big issue is that that was for southeast England, and we have the same sort of figures for northwest England. Flooding is much more local, and it's all about often high-intensity rainfall in a location. And over the last few years, we've developed at the Met Office now a very world-class forecasting system at the kilometre scale. And we wanted to exercise this also within the Flood Resilience Review because, of course, the landscape of the Cumbrian Fells is crucial for extreme rainfall. This is what it looks like at a 12-kilometre model resolution, and that's the rainfall that you get out. I think this is the Cockermouth event. This is the same thing at our kilometre scale modelling, and that's the rainfall you get from that. So clearly landscape, local meteorology, really crucial for getting the high-intensity rainfall that was driving the flooding in Cumbria. This is actually the forecast that we made for Storm Desmond out to 36 hours ahead, and you can see the very bright colours, 16 millimetres an hour in excess of. This is the hose pipe I talked about, and the very bright colours now forming over the Cumbrian Fells, continuous rain, quite heavy rates of rain, becoming purple at some point and just leading to the very severe flooding. So what we wanted to do was to really, to do this properly, is to say, well, okay, the global model's giving us the weather patterns. We then like to downscale them to get the local meteorology and the rainfall as we do every day in forecasting, give that to the Environment Agency so they can produce their flooding scenarios and we can look at what the impacts are. We didn't have the time available or even the right data coming from this model to do this step on this occasion. But in the climate projections that we're developing for DEFRA for 2018, we will be doing that step. And so we'll be able to go seamlessly from the global to the local to the impact. So in the 6 weeks that we had, we looked at this in a different way and sort of said, well, for, say, Storm Desmond, could we have had even more rain from a weather system like that? And we can use the climate model simulations to actually say, well, what's the probability of, say, having 10% or 20% or 30% more rainfall than we've observed in recent flooding events? So we decided to actually take a case study approach. When you take all those red dots from the previous figure and look at them statistically, and you say, well, what's the chance of an event which is greater than the maximum observed over these six regions of England and Wales? How much percentage-wise more rainfall could we get? And this swath here is basically using the six regions to give us a measure of the uncertainty in the enhancement in rainfall above what we've observed already as a record. And then we said, well, actually, we have enough data to actually statistically have a robust answer for a 1% chance. We can't go to these lower percentages. We just don't think that we have enough samples with 1,400 years of data. So when we talk about a 0.1% chance, when we've based it on a few decades of observations, you have to ask whether this is robust statistics. But here you can see that actually, if we look at just beating the maximum at any chance, you have about a 10% chance in any of these six large regions of beating your observed maximum in any year, in any winter. So in other words, we're always up for a new record being broken over a large catchment or large region, say, that feeds the Thames or the Severn. And you can go out and say, well, what's my 1% chance in any winter of seeing even more rainfall than my current observed record? And it comes out to be between 15 and 35%, according to these climate model simulations. So we're beginning now to get a handle on how much more rainfall we could get. So we use those numbers to actually then, with the EA, do some real case studies. So we took a combination here. This is Storm Desmond and Storm Ava. We used actually the rainfall from our kilometre scale forecasting model, because we believe that's as good actually as the observations, and we can debate that later on. How well do we actually know what the observed rainfall is? Quite tricky. And then we added, in this case, 20% to that rainfall. We gave the EA fine scale, fine temporal resolution, rainfall scenario, very realistic, just like a real case, and they were able to run that through their flood models, and Doug will talk much more about this in a minute. And this is just a very quick example from Carlisle. The observed flood extents in the dark blue, the extreme flood outline, which is what we do our resilience testing on, is in the pale blue. When you added 20% to the rainfall, in fact, you're still well within the extreme flood outline, and Doug will talk much more about this. This was a really innovative and groundbreaking method of estimating our flood risk, and it's one that we feel, all of us who worked on this through those rather intense few weeks at the beginning of the year, we feel that actually that sets the pattern now for how we, certainly in this country, need to estimate flood risk. Because a key message here, natural variability will dominate many of our risks going forward, and we need to get a handle on what is meteorologically plausible at the tails of the distribution beyond what we have in the observational record. And we now have the tools. We have models that can do global weather. We can translate that weather into the local weather through nesting down through our kilometre scale forecasting. I haven't talked about probabilistic representation of rainfall, but that's what we're doing now day by day in our forecasting. We also looked at coastal storm surges. I didn't talk about that. It was another feature of the NFRR. And then that rainfall can be fed into a hydrological system. This is a major gap still, I think, in our science capabilities in this country. And we've been having some very good discussions with the Natural Environment Research Council on how we can develop a more integrated hydrological modelling system going forward, so that we know when the water hits the deck from the sky, where does it all go? So from the sky to the sea, basically, where does all our water go in a much more consistent way than we currently handle? And then into the inundation process, the hydraulic modelling that actually was setting up the extreme flood outline, and then through to the impacts and then to our response. So this has been a major outcome of the NFRR, and this is the future, we think, for assessing flood risk. Thank you very much.